Who is he that every man in arms should wish to be? It is the generous spirit who, when brought among the tasks of real life, hath wrought upon the plan that pleased his boyish thought, whose high endeavors are an inward light that makes the path before him always bright, who with a natural instinct to discern what knowledge can perform is diligent to learn, abides by this resolve, and stops not there, but makes his moral being his prime care, who, doomed to go in company with pain and fear and bloodshed, miserable train, turns his necessity to glorious gain, who, if he be called upon to face some awful moment to which heaven has joined great issues, good or bad for humankind, is happy as a lover and stirred with sudden brightness like a man inspired. This is the happy warrior. This is he that every man in arms should wish to be. And this poem from Lord Byron. They never fail who die in a great cause. The block may soak their gore. Their heads may sodden in the sun. Their limbs be strung to city gates and castle walls. But still, their spirit walks abroad. Though years elapse and others share as dark a doom, they but augment the deep and sweeping thoughts which overpower all others and conduct the world at last to freedom. And this from the pen of George Eliot. Oh, may I join the choir invisible of those immortal dead who live again in minds made better by their presence. Live in pulses stirred to generosity, in deeds of daring rectitude, in scorn for miserable aims that end with self, in thoughts sublime that pierce the night like stars, and with their mild persistence urge man's search to vaster issues. So to live is heaven, to make undying music in the world, breathing as beauteous order that controls with growing sway the growing life of man. So we inherit that sweet purity for which we struggled, failed, and agonized, with widening retrospect that bred despair. This is life to come, which martyred men have made more glorious for us who strive to follow. May I reach that purest heaven, be to other souls the cup of strength in some great agony, and kindle generous ardor, feed pure love, beget the smiles that have no cruelty, be the sweet presence of a good diffused, and in diffusion evermore intense. So shall I join the choir invisible, whose music is the gladness of the world. And finally, these brief lines of Percy Bysshe Shelley. He is not dead. Peace, peace. He is not dead. He doth not sleep. He hath awakened from the dream of life. 'Tis we who lost in stormy visions keep with phantoms an unprofitable strife. He has outsawed the shadow of our night. Envy and calumny and hate and pain and that unrest which men miscall delight can touch him not and torture not again. The one remains. The many change and pass. Heaven's light forever shines. Earth's shadows fly. Life, like a dome of many colored glass, stains the white radiance of eternity.
It is the custom of our people to delay statements of tribute until after the actual act of interment has taken place. We will hold here at the temple a special service of memorial for President Kennedy Sunday next. But it would be inappropriate also for me to touch this morning on any other theme but that which is preeminent in each of our minds and hearts. And so I would remind you of a phrase of our rabbis that the good and the life-giving live even though they were dead. And I would give this morning a new modicum of life to some of the thoughts and the aspirations of our martyred leader by recalling with you his words to us over the past several years. I begin with two paragraphs which he spoke to us at his inaugural. In your hands, my fellow citizens, more than mine, will rest the final success or failure of our course. Since this country was founded, each generation of Americans has been summoned to give testimony to its national loyalty. Now the trumpet summons us again. Not as a call to bear arms, though arms we need. Not as a call to battle, though embattled we are. But a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle, year in and year out, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation. A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself. Can we forge against these enemies a grand and global alliance, north and south, east and west, that can assure a more fruitful life for all mankind? Will you join in that historic effort? In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility, I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. Now I would place before you words which the President spoke June last concerning the problem of the liberty and rights of each and every one of our citizens. It ought to be possible for American students of any color to attend any public institution they select without having to be backed up by troops. It ought to be possible for American consumers of any color to receive equal service in places of public accommodation without being forced to resort to demonstrations in the street. And it ought to be possible for American citizens of any color to register and to vote in a free election without interference or fear of reprisal. It ought to be possible, in short, for every American to enjoy the privileges of being American without regard to his race or his color. In short, every American ought to have the right to be treated as he would wish to be treated, as one would wish his children to be treated. But this is not the case. The Negro baby born in America today, regardless of the section or the state in which he is born, has about one half as much chance of completing a high school as a white baby born in the same place on the same day. One third as much chance of completing college. One third as much chance of becoming a professional man. Twice as much chance of becoming unemployed. About one seventh as much chance of earning $10,000 a year. A life expectancy which is 7 years shorter, and the prospects of earning only half as much. This is not a sectional issue. Difficulties over segregation and discrimination exist in every city, in every state of our union, producing in many cities a rising tide of discontent that threatens the public safety. Nor is this a partisan issue. In a time of domestic crisis, men of goodwill and generosity should be able to unite, regardless of party or of politics. This is not even a legal or legislative issue alone. It is better to settle these matters in the courts than on the streets, and new laws are needed at every level. But law alone cannot make men see the right. We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated. If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay? 100 years of delay have passed since President Lincoln freed the slaves, yet their heirs, their grandsons, are not yet fully free. They are not yet freed from the bonds of injustice. They are not yet freed from social and economic oppression. And this nation, for all its hopes and all its boasts, will not be fully free until all its citizens are free. We preach freedom around the world, and we mean it, and we cherish our freedom here at home. But are we to say to the world, and much more importantly to each other, that this is the land of the free, except for the Negro, that we have no second-class citizens, except Negroes, that we have no class or caste system, no ghettos, no master race, except with respect to Negroes. Now the time has come for this nation to fulfill its promise. The events in Birmingham and elsewhere have so increased the cries for equality that no city or state or legislative body can prudently choose to ignore them. The fires of frustration and discord are burning in every city, north and south. Where legal remedies are not at hand, redress is sought in the streets, in demonstrations, parades, and protests, which create tension and threaten violence and threaten lives. We face, therefore, a moral crisis as a country and a people. It cannot be met by repressive police action. It cannot be left to increased demonstrations in the streets. It cannot be quieted by token moves or talk. It is time to act in the Congress, in your state and local legislative body, and above all, in our daily lives. It is not enough to pin the blame on others, to say this is a problem of one section of the country or another, or deplore the facts that we face. A great change is at hand, and our task, our obligation, is to make that revolution, that change, peaceful and constructive for all. And I would read to you some words which President Kennedy spoke June last, the American University in Washington. I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth is too rarely perceived. And that is the most important topic on earth, peace. What kind of peace do I mean, and what kind of peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace. That kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living. And the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time. I speak of peace because of the new face of war. Total war makes no sense in an age where great powers can maintain large and relatively invulnerable nuclear forces and refuse to surrender without resort to those forces. It makes no sense in an age wherein a single nuclear weapon contains almost 10 times the explosive force delivered by all the Allied air forces in the Second World War. It makes no sense in an age when the deadly poisons produced by a nuclear exchange would be carried by wind and water and soil and seed to the far corners of the globe, to generations yet unborn. I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuer fall on deaf ears. We have no more urgent task. Some say that it is useless to speak of peace, a world law, a world disarmament, and that it will be useless until the leaders of the Soviet Union adopt a more enlightened attitude. I hope they do. I believe we can help them do it. But I also believe that we must re-examine our own attitudes as individuals, and as a nation, for our attitude is as essential as theirs. First, examine our attitude towards peace itself. Too many of us think it is impossible. Too many think it is unreal. But that is a dangerous, defeatist belief. It leads to the conclusion that war is inevitable, that mankind is doomed, that we are gripped by forces we cannot control. We need not accept that view. Our problems are man-made. Therefore, they can be solved by man. And man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. Man's reason and spirit have often solved the seemingly unsolvable, and we believe they can do it again. I am not referring to the absolute infinite concepts of universal peace and goodwill, of which some fantasies and some fanatics dream. I do not deny the value of hopes and dreams, but we merely invite discouragement and incredulity by making that our only and immediate goal. Let us focus instead on a more practical, more attainable peace, based not on a sudden revolution in human nature, but on a gradual evolution in human institutions, on a series of concrete actions and effective agreement, which are in the interests of all concerned. There is no single simple key to this peace, no grand or magic formula to be adopted by one or two powers. Genuine peace must be the product of many nations, the sum of many acts. It must be dynamic, not static, changing to meet the challenge of each new generation. For peace is a process, a way of solving problems. With such a peace, there will still be quarrels and conflicting interests, as there are within families and nations. World peace, like community peace, does not require that each man love his neighbor. It requires only that they live together with mutual tolerance, submitting their disputes to a just and peaceful settlement. And history teaches us that enmities between nation and between individuals do not last forever. However fixed our likes and dislikes may seem, the tide of time and events will often bring surprising changes in the relations between nations and neighbors. Second, let us re-examine our attitude towards the Soviet Union. It is discouraging to think that their leaders may actually believe what their propagandists write. Truly, as it was written long ago, the wicked flee when no man pursueth. Yet it is sad to read Soviet statements, to realize the extent of the gulf between us. But it is also a warning to the American people not to fall into the same trap as the Soviets, not to see only a distorted and desperate view of the other side, not to see conflict as inevitable, accommodation as impossible, and communication as nothing more than an exchange of threats. No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue. As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. We can still hail the Russian people for their many accomplished achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, and in acts of courage. Today, should total war ever break out again, no matter how, our two nations will be the primary targets. It is an ironic but accurate fact that the two strongest powers are the two in the most danger of devastation. All we have built, all we have worked for, would be destroyed in the first 24 hours. And even in the Cold War, which brings burdens and dangers to so many countries, including our nation's closest allies, our two countries bear the heaviest burden. We are both devoting massive sums of money to weapons that could better be devoted to combat ignorance, poverty, and disease. We are both caught up in a vicious and dangerous cycle, with suspicion on the one side breeding suspicion on the other, and new weapons begetting counter-weapons. In short, both the United States and its allies, and the Soviet Union and its allies, have a mutually deep interest in a just and genuine peace, in a halting of the arms race. Agreements to this end are in the interest of the Soviet Union as well as ours. And even the most hostile nations can be relied upon to accept and keep those treaty obligations, only those treaty obligations which are in their own interest. So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and the means by which these differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future. And we are all mortal. And in closing, I would read to you two short pieces. The first, The Measure of a Man in Public Life, as President Kennedy himself set it out before he entered office. Second, a short prayer which he gave a month ago, the dedication of a monument to the men who had died in the Atlantic during the past century. Of those to whom much is given, much is required. And when at some future date the high court of history sits in judgment on each of us, recording whether in our brief span of service we fulfilled our responsibilities to the state, our success or failure in whatever office we hold would be measured by the answers to four questions. First, were we truly men of courage? With the courage to stand up to one's enemies and the courage to stand up when necessary to one's associates, the courage to resist public pressure as well as private greed. Secondly, were we truly men of judgment? With perceptive judgment of the future as well as the past, of our own mistakes as well as the mistakes of others, with enough wisdom to know what we did not know and enough candor to admit it. Third, were we truly men of integrity, men who never ran out on either the principles in which we believed or the people who believed in us, men whom neither financial gain nor political ambition could ever divert from the fulfillment of our sacred trust. And finally, were we truly men of dedication, with an honor mortgaged to no single individual or group, and compromised by no private obligation or aim, and devoted solely to serving the public good and the national interest? Against the yardstick of his own measure, our present looms large and stands tall. Admiral Rickover wrote me a few days ago describing the ceremony of the commissioning of a new Polaris submarine. And he said that to each captain of the new submarine, he gives a plaque which contains an old Breton prayer. O God, the sea is so great, and my boat is so small. The sea has been a friend or an enemy of us all, but has never since our earliest beginning carried special hazards for the people of this country. We started as a beachhead on this continent. Our forebears came by that sea to this land. The sea has been our friend and on occasions our enemy. But to life on the sea with all its changes and hazards was added the struggle with man. And it is a struggle of nature and man which cost us the lives of 4,500 Americans whom we commemorate today. I am sure that their families who will come here and read their names may wonder on occasion whether this rather extraordinary act on their behalf was worthwhile. It is, after all, against the law of nature for parents to bury their children. Children should bury their fathers. And when it's necessary for a father or mother to bury a son with all of his life before him, it represents a special wrench. And I'm sure they wonder, with all of the bright promises, particularly of those who fell in World War I and World War II, what it all meant that we as a nation should be in such hazard today. I suppose it means that every generation of Americans must be expected in their time to do their part, must be expected in their time to do their part to maintain freedom for their country, freedom for those associated with it, and that there is no final victory, but rather all Americans must be always prepared to play their proper part in a difficult and dangerous world. His part he played most nobly. Amen.